This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
You know, in October 2007, President Bush announced a $500 million per year security cooperation plan with Mexico, the Meridia Initiative, or Plan Mexico. Well, while the rationale for this program was to fight a war on drugs and gang violence in Mexico, these resources are increasingly being used to militarize the Mexican state in opposition to increasing popular movements in Oaxaca and Chiapas and indeed across Mexico. Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy, has worked as a foreign policy analyst and journalist in Mexico for over two decades now. Let's listen to Laura Carlson as she recently spoke at Blue Stockings Bookstore in Manhattan on Plan Mexico, the Meridia Initiative.
Well, first of all, I want to thank all of you for being here tonight. Plan Mexico is an aid package that's focused on military and police aid. Many of you may have heard about it under the name of the Mérida Initiative. Basically, this was announced on October 22nd of last year, and it was presented as if it were an initiative in order to have the United States support the government of President Felipe Calderón in the war on drugs in Mexico, and as if it were an idea of Calderón's that came up in the context of this war on drugs and was presented to President Bush to help him out. We know that that's not true. Actually, the Plan Mexico came out of a long process that's called the Security and Prosperity Partnership that was a secret extension of NAFTA, of the North American Free Trade Agreement, that began in 2003. This Security and Prosperity Partnership is a way of extending many of the favors that have been granted transnational corporations to go into Mexico to use cheap labor and natural resources under the most privileged kinds of terms imaginable, to extend those favors to them and to begin to include something that wasn't included in original NAFTA, which is the issue of security. After 9/11 happened, the Bush administration, of course, adopted the dangerous and anti-constitutional national security doctrine, which allowed it to justify unilateral interventions in the whole series of measures that, as we know, resulted in the invasion of Iraq, continues to this day, and became obsessed with the war on terrorism as a means of creating its hegemony in the world, particularly in the Middle East, and also rolling back civil liberties here in the United States. So the purpose of this Security and Prosperity Partnership was to be able to expand this among its closest partners, Canada and Mexico. In this context, Mexico was required to take on some of the kinds of laws like the Patriot Act that have taken place in the United States today and begin to enforce security on its southern border in much the same militarized way that the United States has been enforcing security on the U.S.-Mexico border. This is the context that Plan Mexico comes out of. It's an agenda that was written up in Washington, but that has a particular appeal to President Felipe Calderón in Mexico. Because when he was elected in 2006, he won the elections, we were told, by a half a percentage point. In reality, and this has been documented, there was fraud throughout that electoral process. The Mexican populace was deeply divided between the right-wing candidate and a center-left candidate who promised to make significant changes in the NAFTA model of intervention and in the society itself, providing a safety net for the poor and providing certain measures that would have equalized the distribution of wealth, which has only been more and more polarized since NAFTA went into effect almost 15 years ago. After those elections, there were massive demonstrations against the fraud. They managed to allow Calderón to take office anyway. The institutions that were supposed to protect people against fraud and defend democracy caved, and that his presidency was imposed on the people. He entered the office as a weak president with probably more than half the population not only against him, but adamantly against him, willing to mobilize in demonstrations of 1 to 2 million people. And knowing that his weakness and the division that existed in the country was going to be a problem. This war on drugs model that he's launched in the Mexican countryside is a model that was designed by President Nixon for precisely the same reason. It's a model that strengthens a weak presidency in an anti-democratic way. So in effect, what you have is a weak president leaning on the repressive apparatus of the army and the police force in order to bolster a presidency which has not been able to gain the confidence of the population at large. The first thing that happened was over 25,000 army troops were sent into the streets to fight drug traffickers and organized crime in general. In Mexico, as is the case in the United States, it's probably, there's some debate here, unconstitutional to send the army into the streets. The army is a force that was trained to fight foreign enemies, that has a certain amount of prestige in that role in the history of Mexico, and that is not trained in the kinds of human rights issues that you come into when you have an army actually operating against its own people. The reason that they did this supposedly was because of the corruption in the police forces, but now what we're seeing is that we're at risk for that same kind of corruption, infiltration of drug traffickers and the economic power of drug trafficking to infiltrate the army as well, and also for an increased rise in human rights violations. Many things have also already pointed in that direction. It's been happening for over a year now. There have been people killed at checkpoints set up by the army just for simply passing through and not stopping in time, shot dead. There have been rapes in the countryside. We expect these kinds of violations to continue as the army is increasingly used in the war on drugs model. There are three basic reasons why this is such a terrible idea and why the United States shouldn't even consider funding it. The first is that it's dangerous for Mexico. The second is that it's dangerous for the United States. And the third is that it's simply a model of fighting organized crime that we know for a fact from historic experience just plain doesn't work. So the first reason is really one of the importance and the ones that I'll focus on today, and that's why this is so dangerous for Mexico. Mexico is in a situation, as I already mentioned, where there's a deeply divided population politically, but there's also a deeply divided population economically. And this is a direct result of U.S. trade policies and of NAFTA. The polarization of the wealth in the country itself has grown to such a point that we now have the richest man in the world, a multi-billionaire by the name of Carlos Slim, who made his fortune off the corrupt privatization of the telecommunications industry, where he was granted a 7-year monopoly that he's been able to virtually maintain to this day as he expanded his empire, and a growing number of people who live in poverty and extreme poverty. This is especially true in the countryside where NAFTA has displaced 2 million farmers, many of whom have become immigrants to the United States because they no longer have a way to make a living within Mexico. We also have a situation of very grave human rights violations. I was honored and privileged to be a member of the International Civil Commission on Human Rights just this last week, actually. We just finished up last week. This was a commission that's formed of people, mostly Europeans, who got together after the massacre in Acteal, Chiapas in 1997 and created a commission to document the human rights violations that were going on and to push the Mexican government to take responsibility for investigating and prosecuting the perpetrators of these violations. Since then, they've come and they've investigated several situations in the country, including Chiapas and the persecution of the Zapatista communities there, as well as the situation in Oaxaca where Brad Will was killed after the uprising in Oaxaca began with the teacher's strike and went into a generalized protest. This commission this year, the one that we just finished, investigated in particular what was happening in Chiapas and what was happening in Oaxaca over a year since the crisis stage of the demonstrations. I live in Mexico. I read the papers every day. I have a fairly informed view, I think, of what goes on. And yet I wasn't prepared for the kind of direct testimonies that we spent days and days gathering in these communities. To hear about what these people went through and to know that the criminals who were responsible for the tortures and the rapes and the arbitrary detentions and the disappearances of loved ones are not only at large, but have been, in most cases, rewarded by the political and economic system in place for what happened, even though, in many cases, they're clearly identified, everybody knows who they are, was something that was very, very difficult to see. And they're also supported by the government. They have direct affiliations with the PRI, which is a former ruling party. But they also have received some forms of support, or at least a certain silent complicity from the present government, which is another party, which is PRD. These actions have been increasing at an alarming rate in Chiapas. In addition to trying to take back the land and push the Zapatistas off, there's a steady pattern of arresting Zapatista leaders in the area and taking them to prison, accusing them of crimes that are completely invented, torturing them, and then giving them these extremely long sentences where they're basically put away and taken out of commission for up to 20, 30 years. There's almost no redress, judicial or otherwise, in these situations. The Zapatista communities have been trying not to react to this violence against them with more violence because they know that could bring down on their heads an even stronger and more overt kind of repression. So the situation is permanently at a near crisis point. And the cost of resistance is getting higher and higher, while at the same time there seems to be a lack of both national and international attention to what's going on there. In the case of Oaxaca, we opened up an office in Oaxaca City to take testimonies from people. So we had a schedule planned about who was going to testify, a number of grassroots organizations. We were going to have interviews with some government officials, and there was a schedule made up, right? So we open up the doors to this place, and suddenly people start pouring in, literally by the scores, who want to talk about what's happened to them and who want to talk about what's still happening to them. The commission came in having already taken testimony of what happened after the 2006 uprising and repression, and they were basically just trying to figure out what's happened in the last year. And it turns out that there have been almost as many violations of human rights in the subsequent year as there were during the crisis period. And this is happening at a time when the Oaxaca government's going around saying, been there, done that, we got over it, everything's just fine now, everything's under control, peaceful. And in fact, there's this low profile but extremely intense forms of repression going on throughout the state. We heard testimony after testimony of people who've been detained, forced disappearances of people who still haven't shown up, family members that who don't know where their loved ones are, violent deaths, and there's a pattern there that is very clearly has to do with coming down against leaders and activists in the movements who have been trying to continue with the movement that arose in Chiapas and actually has been going on for decades, and are being met with this kind of response on the part of the state. In Mexico, just in last year alone, in 2007, over 7 million people marched in the streets. These were people who said no to what was going on and who asked for a change in their country. What we're seeing now is a response on the part of the state to that kind of widespread social movement that, if there is a plan, Mexico will likely to become more and more repressive as time goes on and as the movement becomes stronger and more frustrated with any other types of channels for redress. After having the fraud dismissed from the courts, after marching, after creating alternatives as they did in Oaxaca, when there's nothing left, and the state is taking this kind of attitude, we're very afraid that we'll enter into a period of more violent confrontations. Now, I mentioned that there were two other reasons why this is dangerous, and one is that it's dangerous for the United States. in this sense, it's not only a question that we have to be responsible for what our tax dollars are doing in other countries, but we also have to recognize that it's certainly not in the interest of the United States to have Mexico in a situation of repression and regression in terms of the construction of strong democratic institutions. As that instability becomes more and more of a reality, it will create more instability on the border. It will create probably more immigration at a time when the U.S. response, as we know, to immigration is also a repressive and a militarized model. And it will make it more and more difficult for us to create this kind of secure and prosperous binational relationship that is the pretext for creating this plan Mexico in the first place. So there's no doubt whatsoever that this is a counterproductive measure in terms of the kinds of objectives that they're telling us are really behind the plan itself. And the last point that had to do with that is the fact that this plan Mexico, as we insist on calling it because it is so similar to Plan Colombia, is not a plan that has any possibility whatsoever of working in clamping down on organized crime. The plan, the war on drugs model that they've applied in Colombia and that they're seeking to apply here is focused on cutting off supply through interdiction and enforcement measures. And in Plan Colombia, there are no funds whatsoever for rehabilitation, for preventing addictions, or for getting some of these substances out of the black market, which could include certain types of legalization. So what that means is that you basically, and this is what we're seeing in Mexico and why the violence has increased, there were over 2,500 drug-related deaths just last year alone. It means that they're confrontations. It's a series of confrontation after confrontation. And there's never any efforts directed at looking at what the root causes are. In Mexico, we have a situation where there's growing production, there's growing consumption, but the primary problem is as a transit link between production in South America, particularly Colombia, and going into the United States. The United States says that this plan, by giving $500 million to Mexico, is a way for them to become co-responsible for fixing the problem of drug trafficking in Mexico. And yet, the kinds of measures that should be taking place in the United States, which have to do with cutting back on demand, which have to do with rehabilitation, prevention, as well as looking at some of the related problems that take place in this country, which are money laundering, a major link in all of the illicit cartel action, and gun running, the weapons that are coming from the north down into the south to arm these drug cartels are not being attacked, are not being looked at within Plan Mexico itself. But I painted a very grim picture of the human rights situation in Mexico, and it's unfortunately accurate. So it's a lesson that we learned firsthand as part of this recent Human Rights Commission. I think they're looking at this plan to be able to preempt or to overtly repress those movements which are growing. There were 200,000 farmers and their supporters in the streets demanding a renegotiation of NAFTA on January 31st. That movement is not going to go away because they're not going to renegotiate NAFTA. And they are saying that with the final elimination, this was on January 1st, NAFTA, the last phase of implementation went into effect, which eliminated tariffs on corn and beans and some of the staple crops that are both fundamental to the Mexican diet, especially for the poor, and to livelihoods in the countryside, especially among small farmers. That was the source of those demonstrations and will continue to be a major crisis point within the Mexican countryside and a means of mobilization. When, and it seems to be very soon, they present the measure to privatize, whether they call it that or not, Pemex, the state-owned Mexican oil company, there's going to be a major reaction because the center-left candidate who won but supposedly lost the elections in 2006 has created a network that is capable of mobilizing throughout the country to defend Pemex as a public resource and will do that when the privatization measures come through. So what you have is what we've seen throughout Latin America, that these free trade models create a polarization of interests and of wealth and a social grassroots resentment that requires an ever more repressive state to control. Plan Mexico comes in at a time when that groundswell from the bottom up against these policies is rising, when there's a government that wants to make these policies even deeper and more extended than has been true in the past. You're running toward a direct contradiction, and they're figuring out the way to win in that battle is to rely on a more militarized and army-based society. We think that the Bush administration has a very clear geopolitical objective involved in Plan Mexico, and that the similarities between Plan Mexico and Plan Colombia go beyond the fact that it's a war on drugs, a failed war on drugs, and include the fact that it creates a military sort of beachhead for the U.S. Army in a region that has been progressively rejecting U.S. intervention, in a region that the United States feels that it has been losing hegemony, both on the economic front to other interests, as well as on the military front, and in particular with what they consider the threat from Hugo Chavez. When you talk to people, they will often say, we have to have this Plan Mexico because we have to have a way to be engaged with Mexico, which is our strongest ally in the region, and counteract the growing influence of Hugo Chavez and other, in particular, but also other progressive, more progressive center-left governments in the area. So they're seeing this as an ideological battle, and yet are unable to put it into the kind of context that I think all of us would hear a prefer, which is a context of looking on these changes that are happening in Latin America, where people are beginning to demand modifications in neoliberalism, in the economic model, because of the inequality and the poverty that it's created, instead of seeing those experiments and those demands as a positive way forward for developing countries. Plan Mexico is the clear indication of how the U.S. government is planning to respond to those as threats in a way that includes increasing its military, its capacity for military action in the hemisphere. But I think it's very important to talk about the other side too. Plan Mexico is a model for stepping on a dream in Mexico in a U.S. Army-issued boot. And what is that dream? The dream is a dream that's happening, that happened and is still happening in both Oaxaca and Chiapas. In Chiapas, the dream is indigenous communities that by law have been denied their autonomy that they have a right to. They have a right to under the ILO Convention number 169, and because of a long history of struggle and presence in the hemisphere. And so they've decided to create a de facto autonomy in their communities. What they're achieving there is impressive. They have local governments that are run by the people themselves, and where even non-Zapatista communities come to them for peaceful mediation of conflicts in the zone. They have health clinics that, again, are giving services not only to Zapatistas in zones where there were never health services before, but are also providing it to non-Zapatistas, to all people who need it. They have schools that are run by them, that are training school teachers, and that are teaching social justice along with arithmetic and other traditional materials. This is the dream that providing funds for Plan Mexico and providing funds to the Calderon government would be under attack under this plan. In Oaxaca, the case of the dream is starting back 2 years ago, when people went out in the streets with basically, it began with a collective no. Oaxaca's a state that's been run by what we call caciques, who are rural bosses that control the local governments and control the local economies. And it's been run by a corrupt government, in this case, a governor who, again, came to power under a fraud. And what happened, beginning with the teachers' strike, is that it spread throughout the society that they just said, we don't have to put up with this anymore, and we're not going to. People went out into the streets. All of a sudden, women are taking over media, which were spreading lies, and said, we don't have to put up with the lies. We don't have to put up with the control. And something happened that, in some cases, been maybe somewhat grandiosely called the first revolution of the 21st century. It's been called the Oaxaca Commune, in reference to self-government in the Paris Commune. And at the very least, it was a collective statement of demanding social justice. We all know what the response to that dream was. It was to step on it. It was murder, detention, torture, imprisonment. And yet, one of the things that we saw when we went back and started talking to people is that the dream has not died, that those organizations, their organizations and the people themselves are still fighting. They're still fighting with the same demands. They're struggling, but they're not giving up. As U.S. citizens, what we'd have to decide is basically, which side are we going to be on? Are we going to be on the side of the dream, or are we going to be on the side of the boot?
And that was Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy, who has worked as a foreign policy analyst and journalist in Mexico for over two decades. I'd like to thank you for listening. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report.